just reviewing where we were from yesterday, and then let's see what questions we have on that. So yesterday we introduced the idea of a neutron interferometer, and basically we took a Mach-Zehndler interferometer and mapped it onto a perfect single crystal interferometer. And so we have three blades that are going to interact with the neutron beam by Lowy diffraction, that the incoming state is, we'll label as a pure state zero. We defined a coordinate system, and we said that zero was kx greater than zero, and one kx less than zero. So just a sign of the momentum in the x direction. And we went over and defined the propagators for the blades. And this, the middle blade, because we throw away the neutrons that leave the interferometer, looks like a pi phase shift, like a pi rotation. So it's a little bit of a weird thing that these blades, you know, we have a transmission and reflection coefficient that we added to this so that it was cosine alpha, sine alpha, minus sine alpha. And of course, on the angle depends on the thickness of this. But here, because we throw away the neutrons that leave, regardless of the thickness of that blade, it always looks like a pi rotation. You know, just the, if we kept those neutrons, the efficiency of the pi rotation would change. Okay, and we saw that if we looked at the O-beam, that there was a contrast. So this is the intensity in the O-beam versus this angle of the phase shifter, and that the H-beam is the complement of that, and of course the sum of those ideally is one. When we changed to allow the transmission reflection coefficients to not be equal, so in this case, T is equal to R, when we changed that, then what we found is that there was, if I draw it correctly, that the contrast curves changed in this way, that the O beam should still go to zero, the H beam should still go to maximum intensity, but it won't reach zero, and the O beam won't reach maximum intensity. And that's the effect of having a finite difference. So T is not equal to R. And we could describe that. Now, of course, that process is still perfectly unitary. Everything is good with the system. And then we wanted to describe this system as a map. And so if I describe it as a map, then I would picture that we have this process and that there's some input density matrix that impinges on the first blade. And of course, in the experiments, that input state is always pure, always directed to the zero beam. Yeah?
Go on to that mapping thing.
Sure.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Could you please explain a little further as to how the quantum operation that you chose to represent the thing between the first two plates is corresponding with the physical situation?
Okay. So here, let me see if I understand your question. There's perhaps two questions you could be asking. One, you could say, why is this operation a sigma z operation? Okay, and the other question is, can I relate phi to a property of the material here? Okay, so the first question of why is it a sigma z operation? Let's look at that. It's a sigma z operation because we've labeled these paths still. So this is still 0 and 1. And so we've said that there's a phase difference that we're applying over those two paths. I'm not changing those paths. I'm only changing the energy over those paths. And so in general, the phase flag would look like I have a certain phase applied along, don't do that, applied along 0. So let's call that phase 0. Just thinking about the action, and some phase I'm applying to the object in the one state, right? So there's some phase here, some phase there. And then I would recognize this idempotent as being the identity plus sigma z divided by 2, and this idempotent or projector as the identity minus sigma z over 2. Okay, and then we can combine those two. And I've now dropped the global phase from this, so there's only one phase. Yep. And you know, you can see there's a piece that comes in as that identity, so that's all easy. And then you say, well, okay, fine, take it as sigma z, but now why, what is phi? And phi, in the simplest case, where we have no magnetic or other interactions, is the number density of atoms in the sample across section. Yeah, sorry. So the coherent cross section the wavelength or the energy, basically we need to say, hey, how long has it been there, right? And so I have a path length here. And in this case, the wavelength of the particle. And normally we think that there is a thickness to this. So I would say, okay, there's some thickness W, and there's some angle theta, and we'll relate D to W cosine theta. This coherent cross-section comes out of a formulation which is typically called an optical potential, that what you imagine is you have the neutrons coming in. They're going to interact with the nuclei of the other material. It's going to interact as a point source. And so we have a sum over all of the atoms in the system. And then that is averaged to some potential. We call it this. Okay. Now there's, in the notes, I give you also magnetic and gravitational and other potentials. And basically, you know, you can think about these things as saying, you've got the Schrodinger equation. So I have a particle with mass traveling through a media. The particle has an energy. The media has a potential. And the effective velocity of that particle through that media is going to vary with the potential. And that's why when we looked at the magnetic part, we saw that spread in potentials. Yeah? So we have this potential. Then what we're going to do is to say, hey, it's effectively slowed down for some time. Okay? And so since it's slowed down for different times in these different paths, it will recombine here with different phases. And so that the interference effect is going to show up because of the effective path length difference in those two arms of the interferometer. Now, tomorrow we'll talk about the wave packet picture of this, and we'll see that again. Okay? Yeah?
Just a brief comment. The fact that we are throwing away some of the particles here, does that have any consequence that we need for reversible quantum computation? Or?
Okay, so there are a lot of quantum processors which will never be a quantum computer. And this is one of them. In fact, what we usually find, unfortunately, or what we've found so far, is now that they had to turn off the camera. Now then, I'm sure they won't, but I'll find this somewhere where I don't want to see it. What happens is that if we know enough about a quantum system, we find out all those reasons why it's really hard to make a quantum computer. We have great control. But you want to have a quantum computer, you really have to find an effective way of getting rid of the noise, removing entropy from your system. And that is hard to do. We can't do that here. Okay? So we can do all the protocols for quantum computing. We can explore coherent control. We'll talk about some of those. But this isn't the way of building a quantum computer. Okay? So we'll hopefully touch on some more promising approaches. This is a great way of exploring coherent control, however. That's what we're going to do. Okay, so now then, let's continue to this map. So we describe it as a map, and we say, okay, we have some input state here, and it's going to go to some output state. And I'm going to describe that as a generalized map. I'm not going to describe it by a unitary process, because I'm not going to restrict it to being unitary. In fact, by describing it as this map, I'm not even going to restrict it to being completely positive, which would mean that this might not actually be a valid density matrix. Okay, but for everything we talk about today, in the next couple days, we will have a valid density matrix to a valid density matrix. But the formalism is more general than that. Okay, so then we said, if we redraw this again, and now we have rho in here, and we look at the action of this blade. Well, we know the propagator of that blade here. And so I can say, fine, what does that correspond to as a Hamiltonian picture? Or just think about it as a rotation times some Pauli matrix. And so this corresponds to a pi over 2 rotation about sigma y. And here I'm writing it as the rotation angle. So if I was going to write this as a propagator, it would be e to the I pi over 4 sigma y, right? There's an extra factor of 2 in the propagator, just to normalize things. So we've got this pi over 2 rotation. Here we have an alpha, no, let's keep the same length of phi rotation of sigma z. Here, there's a pi rotation about sigma y. And this final blade gives us another pi over 2 rotation about sigma y. Yeah? And so let's combine this. And so we've got a pi rotation sigma y. And time is going left to right for me here, right? So I'm not ordering these like propagators. We have this phi rotation sigma z. Now I've got two rotations here. These two rotations, of course, commute. So you'll allow me to write that as a minus pi over 2 rotation about sigma y. Yeah? And now life is good because you recognize these as performing a similarity transform of this particular operator. And so now we have a phi rotation about sigma x. Yeah? And that's the entire map of this. And so you can see right here, and you saw it in the recitation, that in fact, with just this interferometer, we cannot have a map that occupies all of SU2, or in other words, we can't cover the whole Bloch sphere, right? You remember that the Bloch sphere is a mapping of the expectation values of the Pauli operators in SU2. Yeah? Okay, so we have this piece here. Now I'm going to ask you as a homework, to imagine that the blades have variable thickness, that we can't do that experimentally, but as a thought process, we can. Imagine that we could control the thickness of the blades. And so instead of having a pi over 2 rotation here, I have a theta rotation. And tell me if we can then cover the whole Bloch sphere. OK, so tell me what the map is in that particular case. Yeah.
Are we presuming then that we can control the thicknesses of each of the three blades independently?
Nope. Nope. Have it so that we can have just one parameter.
Okay.
Thanks for the question. Okay. Now, we added to this. Oh. Okay. So let's say what S is. So if we have S in this particular case, then we see that it's just this effective mapping of sigma x. And so what we expect is that the actions of this map is the identity maps to the identity, sigma x maps to sigma x, sigma y maps to cosine phi. Put sigma y in front. Now I have to think about this plus sigma z sine phi n sigma z maps to sigma z cosine phi minus sigma y sine phi. Yeah? And the super operator just tells us that particular mapping. So the super operator that we would have here is so. And we described how to calculate that. We're going to go over that again just briefly. Better put a line there so that's two separate ideas, but there's our super operator. And of course, you can see directly that this looks like it's a unitary process, right? So we never go inside the Bloch sphere. Everything we would do, we start out, if we start on the surface of the Bloch sphere, we stay on the surface of the Bloch sphere. Okay, then we said, let's add an interaction, which is a magnetic interaction. And in this case, we imagine that on the incoming side, we have the spin state of the neutron in its fully mixed state. So that the neutron, which is spin 1/2 particle, comes in either spin up or spin down. Okay? And no coherence. It's either spin up or spin down. It interacts with the blade. We add a magnetic cross-section to the blade. And so now there's an additional shift. And I want to draw this. So we see that we have half the neutrons that are in the state up. And they're going to receive a phase shift that is plus, I guess we used alpha, plus alpha sigma z. And we have half the neutrons in the down state, and they'll receive a phase shift that's minus alpha sigma z. Now, it seems for a second that, hey, we should expand and look at the problem in SU4. But in fact, the spin state of the neutrons is never varied in this process, nor is any of our measurements dependent upon the spin state. And so the spin state remains a separable quantity throughout the whole process. And so we're just going to forget the spin state. We'll just use it as a label. And so we start off with our incoming state here, okay, along plus z, just in the Bloch sphere, we have the same first blade, which is this rotation about sigma y. So after the first split, we end up along x. I should label these things. And that's exactly the same. Now, in this case, what happens is we apply phi, the system rotated. But now, what happens is at that blade, at that phase shifter, we get two quantities separated by two alpha. Okay? And if I look at the projection of those, then of course the projection shrinks. Right? Because I'm only going to be measuring the sum of those two vectors, and some of those two vectors will remain always along the x direction. Okay, but it will shrink. And so we can go through the whole analysis. But trivially, we can see that the superoperator in this case. Now remember, this is a superoperator for the whole process. So I've added this blade. And so here we have a sigma z rotation. But just like over here, that sigma z rotation is going to be converted into an effective action along the x-axis, which is an attenuation in this case. And so now we have a mapping which shows that the vector shrinks, okay? And that the components along both z and y will shrink. The components along x would remain constant. And the identity part is not varied in this case. Yeah?
And this corresponds to the situation where we don't have a phase flag?
Yes, that's exactly right. So that if I added a phase flag, then I would rotate this unitarily. And so, you know, we can write that down. If we have both a phase flag and we have the magnetic piece. Give us an alpha sine phi and cosine alpha. Sorry for the mess. Yep. Yes, please. Yep.
Where is the magnetic field? There's no magnetic field.
It's inside this material.
Inside the phase flag?
Inside the phase flag. So it says that as we're. So think about it as a hard magnet. You know, if I take. They're beautiful half metals. There's a new half semiconductor that we like to play with, the europium oxide. If I look at europium oxide by a half semiconductor, all of the free electrons have the same spin. And the internal field is 14 tesla inside there. So it's a huge field internally in this material. And we can use that as a label of the magnetic potential of the neutrons. Yeah. Okay. So now we've got the super operator. If we think about writing down the ijth component of this. Yeah, please.
Can you remind me why the thing on the second blade is written as a two-way two-block matrix?
Here. Here.
Yeah.
So I've written it as a unitary process, simply to say that it's acting on the that it's a propagator over SU2. And remember that what we're doing is throwing away the outcoming neutron beam. And what the action of this is to convert 0 to 1 and 1 to 0.
Maybe we should start further back. So as I understood it, like you have on the first plate in the matrix 1, negative 1, 1, 1.
Right.
And I interpreted that as the action of this blade is to multiply the density matrix by this thing.
So that's the propagator. So remember that if I have rho out, it's equal to u rho in u inverse. Yeah?
It looks there like the I is supposed to be the identity matrix of some other system.
It's just minus 1. The square root is minus 1. No. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's the imaginary number.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's a good thing you're here too. Yeah. Okay, good. So now if we think about looking at the construction of the superoperator, we already saw that right here. That if we wanted to construct the superoperator, what we need to do is look at the action of our process on a complete basis in the Hilbert space, and then look at how that is mapped. And these, of course, are the rows of the superoperator. Okay, so everything is actually defined there. But you know, we can say, fine, we can define it a little bit more formally. Where these are the Pauli matrices, and I'll just label them as 0, 1, 2, 3, identity x, y, z. And this would be the case if we have a purely unitary process. If, as in the magnetic case, we have a probability, a classical probability, and some action, right? The probability and associated propagator. Then we would modify this. I'll put it up here. To take a sum over this, where then again, this is a probability, and sum over p sub k is equal to 1. Okay, so that's everything that we did yesterday. And I wanted to make sure that we came back to these maps, because these maps are going to be important to the discussion. And I think what we're going to see today is going to be new to you as I look at playing with these maps. So any questions, any more questions on any of this? Yeah, please.
I need to know your notation. Like you already mentioned how the transmission matrix, or which one is your information about them? Because from the matrix of that, I will see the sign change for.
Yeah, and. So if I take a columnized version of the density matrix and I apply it, I probably have applied it wrong. Okay? So yeah, change the signs.
What is the quantity u there? Is that for a system that is unitarily evolving under just one?
So it's an effective propagator over the whole system.
Okay.
So just as here, we said the effective propagator of this is some angle rotation by sigma x. It's just that effective propagator. And of course, if we have a complex series of propagators as we do here, we can always combine them into one effective propagator. Okay. All right, so homework question number 2 is I'd like you to take this super operator and add to it the thickness of the blade. Okay, so add the thickness of the blade to the super operator. So it's connected to the first question that we had. Okay, so now I'm going to add some complexity to this problem. And the way I'm going to do that is I want to add a dispersion of phase shift. So instead of having just one phase shift, or in fact two phase shifts, I'm going to change it so that we have a continuum of phase shifts. And look at how we would describe that. And then I'm going to extend that to adding noise to the system. The way we're going to add phase shifts to start with is to put a prism in the beam blade. And this is a useful experiment because it allows us to do imaging. But I'm not going to focus on imaging at the moment. I just want to focus on how to describe the system when we have a dispersion. Now, I don't know how to draw this correctly. And so let me draw it a few ways, and then we'll make sure that you get the picture. Let me rotate this whole thing so that we've got our neutron interferometer with its base sitting over here. There's an incoming neutron beam. Remember that we said the neutron beam is about 8 millimeters high, so that this here is 8 millimeters. And what I'm going to do is in one leg of this neutron beam, I'm going to put a wedge that's carefully machined from silica. And so the neutron beam is going to pass through that. And you can see that is going to pick up a phase shift that depends upon the height, its height in the beam. And remember that this direction is z, the z coordinate. And so we'll pick up a phase shift that depends upon z and the wave number of the prism. So q is a wave number. And it's equal to 2 pi divided by the periodicity. And if I took this prism and I said, OK, what is the phase shift in that prism? Then what we would see is that the phase shift is linearly increasing 0 to 2 pi. And of course, it wraps around. And that wavelength is exactly the periodicity of this. Yeah? And so what this creates is it creates a helix of the state, right? Because it's going to rotate the state depending upon where it is in that z-axis. So we have a spatial helix of the state at this point. Now, I'm going to add in a phase flag, too. Just so we have another quantity. So we'll call this phi again. Now, it's easy enough to calculate what's going to happen in this case, that we have exactly the same calculation before. You know, u of the blade remains unchanged. The u of the mirror remains unchanged. The phase flag remains as it was. And we introduce the prism. But of course, I need to keep this z coordinate. We need to keep that piece there. Yeah.
By moving the phase one to between the second and third interferometer, then we made it so that it now rotates by negative.
We've put it on the opposite. If I want to be careful here, we've said that it goes to the opposite path, right? Okay, so now let me wake up my computer. If I take this system, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to put right here a detector, which is a position-sensitive detector. So the way these position-sensitive detectors work is I have a thin film, boron, gadolinium, something that, captures a neutron and gives me a charged particle back. Then I have a scintillator screen that gives me a photon from the charged particle. And then I have a CCD detector. So this is neutron to photon. And so now we get a picture of the neutron beam. These are nice for some diagnostics, but they're horrible for quantum efficiency, because you can see what happens. If I make these layers thick enough that we capture all the events, I've moved them so far away from the CCD that we have no resolution. If I make them thin so we have good resolution, then the probability of capture is zilch. Okay, and that's the condition that we all usually work in. Okay, so there is the position-sensitive detector looking at the O and the H beam, and we see this periodic modulation of the potential because, of course, the phase is being wrapped around by 2 pi. And what does the phase do? The phase, of course, directs the neutron to go to either the O or the H detector, right? It's shifting those. And you can see that the O and the H are exactly spatially out of phase with each other, exactly as they should be. And if I... Hey, I thought I had that here. If I change the pitch of the prism, which we can do precisely, then we see that, in fact, this grating changes corresponding to that. Yeah, so all life is good, and we can understand this. And this picture, of course, doesn't add any complexity to everything we said yesterday. All it says is that now I have an intensity as a function of z. And so I can run the exact same process I did last time, and I will get a pure state coming out at each point as a function of z. Yeah?
What would happen if we used atoms instead of neutrons?
The same, you get exactly the same picture. Okay. So Zeilinger, Anton Zeilinger has looked at similar things with buckyballs. He's trying to do it with small viruses. And you see exactly the same dynamics. Now, of course, the what you diffract off has to change. And so there you need a grid. And
the reason I asked was, why would you go the trouble of isolating neutrons if you
could do this for big? Because neutrons are a wonderful probe. They don't have charge. So if you're trying to build a system to understand condensed matter, or even for fundamental physics, we can do much more precise things with neutrons than we can do with charged particles. Yeah, good thing about charged particles is that you can strongly control them. The bad thing is that nature, your environment can too. Okay. Good. Now then, that was the case when we have a position-sensitive detector. And so here we would have the intensity of the O beam as a function of z. What we are usually look at is with a helium-3 detector. And the helium-3 detector is going to integrate over that grid. So we have our spatially sensitive detector. It has this periodic structure. Our helium-3 detector says, let's integrate this over. And here, we've got Z and X. And X in my picture is supposed to be boring. So we just integrate over Z, and we would get that as a quantity. But you would see that you're very quickly going to get no contrast. Right? And so if I take this system and say that I have an effective U that depends upon Z, and that this thing is a rotation of QZ plus phi about the sigma y axis. And then I take over here and replace this sum with an integral. So now then we say that S is equal to, we can leave it inside, S of ij is equal to the trace P of I integral. We have a probability that's uniform, right? So we're just going to integrate over the z coordinates. And we'll have u effective of z, pj, u effective of z inverse, like so. And what we should see out of this is effectively a sinc function, that we're integrating over a square top hat distribution. And you'll remember that the Fourier transform of the top hat distribution looks like a sinc function. Now, since we're integrating over this distribution and we've kept it all positive, what we end up doing is having all positive lobes of the sinc function. And so I show you that. It's, of course, in the notes. But now, this is the O-beam intensity versus the phase shift. So this is the alpha phi, sorry, on the board, phi. And this is our wave vector, Q. And when Q is equal to 0, that corresponds to an infinite period. So we have a spatially homogeneous system, and we see the nice contrast that we expect. As we increase Q, we lose contrast. And at the end of it, we end up with a flat curve with half the neutrons going to each of the two detectors. And of course, if I look at the H beam, it is the complement of that. Yeah? I have no idea what that is. But that all works out simply. And we can now write down when I said it looks like a sinc function, you're just integrating along this line here. Yeah? Just look at the intensity as you shift out that way.
Why do you integrate along the Q direction?
No, I'm sorry, I don't integrate, so I just map it along the Q direction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as I change Q, I'll see a sinc function modulation on top of this. Okay, good. So now then, let's write down the super operator for this picture. So we've got that. We'll lose this. And the super operator, we still have the same structure, that the super operator is this x rotation that we're averaging over. So change your notes. That should be x. My apologies. So the x is not changed. And we still have the phi dependence in the system. But on top of that, I have sine 0.5 q divided by q. So there's our sinc function for the modulation that depends upon q. And this is, I'm going to keep making the same sine error. So I'll be consistently wrong. But if I try to correct it, I won't be consistently wrong. I'll be randomly wrong. OK, and there's our map for this. So that includes all the dynamics for any setting of q. We know what the superoperator map is. Now, notice what's useful about the superoperator map. It gives a really compact representation of what happened over a complex distribution of events. And so the nice thing about the superoperator is it gives a compact representation at one instant in time. The superoperator tells you what is the effective map at that instant in time. Okay, it doesn't give you any right to say what happens at any other instant in time unless you know more about the system. If I know that the system is Markovian, for instance, then I can extend this to other times. But if I don't know that, if all I know is the superoperator at one instant in time, then it just gives me that. It gives me a compact representation at that instant in time. And to make that point clear, let me think about modifying this experiment. What would happen if I put another prism in there? So we can see this pretty easily. We have a prism in the upper beam, in the upper path of this. I shouldn't call it the beam. So we have a prism here that is e to the I qz. So that's the propagator in the upper piece. And then I have a propagator in the lower piece. Let me just call it q prime. There's no reason that those prisms have to have the same wave number. And so I now have these two operators, okay? But they commute. I can combine them together. If I combine them together, I'll have an operator that looks like just taking out the global phase from this. Yeah?
The wave number is a property of prism?
Yes, absolutely. So the wave number is telling us the periodicity of the 2 pi phase shift. Remember this picture.
Okay.
Right? So the wave number tells us the periodicity of the prism, and experimentally, we change that angle of the prism to get different wave numbers. Unfortunately, that's something we can do very precisely. So when I combine those two, as you would expect, I think, that when q prime is equal to q, we remove the effect of having a prism, and what we should see is full contrast being recovered. Now, if I took this superoperator for the upper prism, and I wrote down the corresponding superoperator for the lower prism, which would look the same with a minus sign and q changed to q prime, okay? Otherwise, it would be the same. and I multiply those two together, I wouldn't see that I would recover contrast. I would see that I would lose additional contrast. And what's the problem? The problem is that this superoperator is the result integrated over the distribution. And I can't take that static distribution, take two events, and integrate first and then add. Right? You have to look at the action of that distribution over the whole process and then combine them. So you have to be careful in combining superoperators. Yeah? OK. So we're going to run out of time. And that's a bit unfortunate. Let me just show you this piece. So here I've calculated the O-beam intensity, again, versus the phase flag, versus Q, but I've set Q prime equal to 10. And so you see that when Q is equal to Q prime, it's equal to, they're both equal to 10, we recover the full contrast, that we lose contrast when the two wave numbers are separated from each other. All simple stuff. OK. I'm going to, next class, what we're going to do is we're going to put in a random distribution of phase. I went to NIST, and we wanted to build a new interferometer. And these interferometers are a real drag to build. You have to find a crystal. They don't grow these crystals anymore. So you have to beg, borrow, or steal from your friends. If you're stealing, then maybe it shouldn't be from your friends. And then you take and you try to, you align it with an X-ray source on the milling machine. You mill it as carefully as you're the best machinist around, which tends to be some old guy that's been retired for 10 years, but you know, is willing to come back just as a favor to somebody. And then you try to clean up the blades. And it takes a year to get everything done. And you measure the contrast. And a good interferometer has a contrast of about 80%. And we have a contrast of about 30%. And so you go to your collaborator and you say, hey, what's going on? You know, we wasted a year, we have contrast of 30%. He says, well, that's pretty good, actually. And he takes you back in his office, which he didn't do a year before, and opens up a cabinet and shows you hundreds of useless crystals. He says, about 1 in 50 work. And you think, okay, we're going to invest a year of our time to making one. Only 1 in 50 works. My scientific career doesn't sound that exciting. And the reason is, of course, that we've already seen that the blade thickness matters in that there's a phase shift. And the phase shift is pi, for about 40 microns of material. And so if there's a variation in the thickness of the blade, not the surface properties, but the thickness of the blade, over 40 microns, then we lose our contrast, because then we have a random pi phase shift over there. And no one in the field has really figured out how to control that. So what we're going to do is describe the physics of that, which allows us to say that, hey, we have a Gaussian distribution of random phase shifters here. So now we get to something that really does look random. And then I'm going to show you how to take the superoperator map and reduce it to a compact representation of operators. And so it's useful to have this picture of a finite number, in fact, the number is the dimension of the Hilbert space, a finite number of operators acting on the system, even in the case where we have a continuum of noise sources. And we can do that through the so-called Choi decomposition. And so we'll introduce a random process, so you have something a little bit more interesting to work with. And then we'll show how to extract those operators via the Choi decomposition. Okay, but we'll do that tomorrow. And I'll stop here. Any questions? And remember, you did two homework assignments.
But why do these crystals not get made anymore?
Because you don't need them. What we care about is we care about dislocations over the crystal. And it used to be that the electronics industry cared about dislocations. They don't. What they care about is impurities. So they grow their crystals that have the fewest impurities, and they don't care very much about dislocations. And so it's not that you can't pay someone to grow the crystals with low dislocations, but the typical crystals that are grown for the electronics industry aren't suitable. Yeah?
You represented these two crystals as multiplying these two matrices. What if these crystals were such that the phase shift was along two different directions, like Z and X? How would you represent that by multiplying?
Yes, but I would still have to keep track of the correlations between them. But exactly right. That then I would say that I would have. So you're saying, what if instead of, let's call that qx times x and this qz here, qz times z. And now then I can't combine them this way and take out a global phase, right? So now I have to keep those independent coordinates. Yeah?
What if a single crystal is in place of the world path? Instead of having two prisms?
The prisms are not single crystals.
Sorry, I said, what if a single prism is in place of the world path? So like two crystals.
Oh. It's a drag because I want to orient the crystal, I want to orient the prism, sorry, relative to the beam direction. So with the phase flag, it's flat. And so all I care is that it's perpendicular to z. But here, I want these not only to be perpendicular to z, I want them to be oriented with the momentum of the neutrons. And since those are spread out, I can't do that. Now, I can change the interferometer arrangement. And there's an interferometer. Let's see if I can draw it. All the blades should be the same direction. There's an interferometer that you can make in this so-called skew symmetric arrangement. And again, it's Lowry scattering. I've just shifted things a little bit, but the nice part is that these two beams are perfectly parallel. And so here I could exactly do as you suggest and put a big prism in them. And of course, if I did that, then what I would see wouldn't see anything, right? I mean, the effect of having that prism would be transparent to the detector. Yeah. But these things are widely used. In fact, the gravitation experiment you looked at, this is a useful arrangement for that because I can make this path length longer.